Good morning, everybody. Yeah, that theme means that it's time to welcome Colin Suter and Eric Childress from eFilmCritic.com and RogerEbert.com and more to the show. Every Monday morning, we review the new movies, and we take a look at the box office. We've only got two movies, well, three, but two big ones to review this week. So we'll take a look at the box office, which we do every week. Eric Childress writes an analysis of each weekend's box office report. We take a look at the winners, the losers. We talk about what it means and all that stuff. So we'll do the box office. And then we will also talk about the best movie franchises and series, movie series, because a big one came out this past weekend, the Mission Impossible, the new Mission Impossible movie, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. And we're going to talk about that series and many of the other movie series of the past. So that will be coming up as well right here on 720 WGN. So let's say good morning to Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
And Colin. Hi, Colin.
Hello there.
All righty then. Hey, I have 16 facts about the Mission Impossible movies.
16 okay. of them?
16. I don't know. Okay. I don't know why they chose that specific number. You know, could have been like round it off to 15, maybe find four more and push it to 20.
Mm-hmm.
But it's 16. The Tom Cruise starring Mission Impossible movie franchise brought new life and peel off faces to the classic television series that inspired it. The fifth installment, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, is in theaters now. Let's look back at how we got here. The first one is, it was Tom Cruise's idea to turn the show into a movie. You guys probably knew that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, his production company, he's produced all of them.
Yeah, first movie he ever produced.
First movie he ever produced was the original Mission Impossible. The TV series Mission Impossible aired from 1966 to 73 on CBS, was briefly revived on ABC for two seasons in the late 80s. Really?
Yeah, with Peter Graves and Jane Badler from the V series.
Really? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
And they actually brought Peter Graves back?
Peter Graves was on the show, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Riding the popularity of Airplane, are we?
It was a few years after Airplane, so.
Yeah. Wow, that's crazy. Cruise was a fan of the original show, and he wanted to adapt it to the big screen for Paramount Pictures, who owned the rights. Here's another fact number two. The TV actors weren't happy with the film version.
Gee, I wonder why.
Greg Morris, the man who played Barney Collier, left the first movie early and presumably didn't see any of the sequels. Peter Graves wasn't pleased that the one character name they kept in the series was the name of his TV character, Jim Phelps, played in the movie by John Voight, who, of course, turns out to be a bad guy. Martin Landau, who played Roland Hand, revealed that in an early script, the old TV gang was supposed to appear briefly before getting killed, and he didn't appreciate that.
Well, so he just killed off a whole bunch of new people.
Yeah.
Instead.
Yeah. Number three fact is that the TV director was told to go away. Reza Badyi was behind the camera for more episodes of Mission Impossible series on ABC than anyone else and was invited back by Paramount to consult on the movie. Director Brian De Palma, my guess is De Palma didn't take kindly to that. My guess is like having some TV movie director, you know, consult Brian De Palma's, and that's not going to go over real well.
Right. No, De Palma's never been one for, you know, maintaining the integrity of any source material, as we all know. He kind of likes to just do it his own way. Sometimes
yeah.
the result is good, sometimes not so good.
Always good.
But he does it his own way.
Hey, by the way, I have to say, there's a sequence, and we'll get to this when we review Rogue Nation.
Mm-hmm.
There's a sequence in Rogue Nation where McQuarrie needs to cut a check to De Palma.
That's fine.
There's a set piece, you know, about a third of the way into the movie.
Yeah.
Well, any time you set something at it, you know, during a live performance, you know, like at an opera, you have to cut a check to De Palma. That just that goes with the character.
Well, how about if he just floors the check to the Hitchcock estate instead? Just cut out the middleman. Okay, let's be honest.
All right. Let's see. Where is somebody? Somebody's in a noisy area. Eric, where are you?
That's me. I'm trying to find a quiet area.
Where are you?
Las Vegas.
God, you're in Vegas again?
I am.
Good Lord, man. You know, you should just move there. By the way, De Palma went up to the director on set and told him that the movie wouldn't be anything like the TV show and having him on the set would make things uncomfortable. Body Eye thanked him for his candor and never came back. Okay. All right. And then we'll say, I got one more and then we'll save the rest of them for later. Juliette Binoche and Rachel McAdams turned down lead parts. Did you guys know this?
In the new one?
No. Well, no, I guess in probably different ones. Here we go. Binoche, who won an Oscar for The English Patient, which came out the same year as the first Mission Impossible film, said no to playing Claire Phelps, not wanting to become completely known for appearing in American blockbusters. Emmanuel.
Like Godzilla?
Emmanuel Biart said yes. Well, I mean, this was 20 years ago when she said no to this.
Right.
And to her credit, she's been doing nothing but small French movies for a really long time.
Right.
She's fashioned a nice career for herself.
She has. I think she rules, man.
Yeah, she's great.
And for MI3, McAdams opted out to play Ethan Hunt's fiance, Julia Mead. Michelle Monaghan got the part.
Hmm.
Would have been McAdams. Would have been okay.
Sure.
As long as she didn't try to take Carrie Russell's part. You know, I don't want to hear about that.
Well, that was already preordained.
Well, of course it was. J.J. Abrams is she going to be in the star? Is she in Star Wars, man? Come on.
I don't think so.
By the way, when did J.J. Abrams officially become a producer on this series?
Probably after part three, right?
After the third one.
Yeah, I think all of them have been under the Bad Robot production company.
All of them? Oh, all of them since then.
Since the third one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. All right, well, let's do this. Here are your estimated three-day box office returns. Number one movie in the country, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, $56 million. Interesting how you wrote about this, Eric.
Yeah.
About how it can be interpreted. Talk a little bit about that. That's a $56 million for Rogue Nation.
Yeah, well, I mean, well, obviously we're going to get into, you know, what we all think about the movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, you think about, you know, a number like 56, you know, a big franchise, a summer movie, you know, especially the way all these other blockbusters are hitting, you know, nine-digit figures and things like that. Those are the kind of numbers you kind of wish that the Mission Impossible series would do. But on the other hand, you know, for this series and for Tom Cruise's career, these are incredibly strong numbers. This is the third highest opening of his career, just behind War of the Worlds and the second Mission Impossible movie. And it had the second best first day opening in Cruise's career behind War of the Worlds. And it's the second highest opening in the series, in the franchise. So, you know, franchise-wise, these are incredibly strong numbers. But at the same time, you know, Ant-Man made more.
Yeah.
You know, so it's just like, it's just one of those things where you think that, especially after the last one, Ghost Protocol, you know, had a very interesting opening when it opened in December of just a few years ago. And they originally opened it on like 425 IMAX screens.
Right.
And so it was open in IMAX before it was opening anywhere else. And just on IMAX screens, it did like $12 million. And then the next couple weeks, it had the benefit or the hazard of having the Christmas Eve and New Year's Eve holidays and Christmas and New Year's Day proper on those very weekends. And the word of mouth kept that thing, you know, just chugging until it became almost, you know, one of the few $200 million grosses in Cruise's career.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, it'll be interesting to see what happens here. you know. And again, we can talk more about it when we actually get into the reviews of the film. But yeah. $56 million. You know, when I saw those numbers, I thought I was disappointed when I saw that because of exactly what you said. I mean, the first thing that popped into my head when I saw the number was Ant-Man made more.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's also odd, too, that, you know, I mean, we've talked about this a couple times with these tracking companies that, you know, they think they got the finger on the pulse of, you know, awareness and what, you know, movies are going to do opening weekend. We've been saying this, but they've been wrong all summer. And all week, they were sticking to their guns that this movie was going to make in the low 40s. Yeah. You know, and I don't know if that was some strategy employed by Paramount. So when, you know, you get a number like $56 million, all of a sudden, it's cause for celebration. But it started off low 40s, they said, earlier in the week. Then Friday came, and they said, oh, it looks like it's going to do 50. And then it was 52, and then turned out to be 56. So there has to be happiness all around.
Now, there's no competition this coming weekend, is there?
Well, Fantastic Four opens.
Oh, please.
That's exactly.
And by the way, they put an embargo on, right? They're not even screening it, are they?
The screen that two nights before it opens.
Oh, they are.
One night before it opens, technically, yeah.
Oh, okay.
You count the Thursday night showing, you know, in certain places, then they're screening it Wednesday night.
Okay.
So not a good sign.
Okay. Yeah, well, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see how much of a drop Mission Impossible make. Well, maybe Fantastic Four will be number one next week. Do you think Fantastic Four is going to be number one?
I think it depends on Mission Impossible's drop, actually. I mean, if Mission Impossible has some sort of really strong, you know, almost, you know, semi-historic small drop, I think that it could actually be number one next week. Because I have a feeling Fantastic Four is not going to open very strong.
I got a feeling, too.
It's not going to do Ant-Man numbers.
No, I agree. And, I don't know anybody, regular person or comic book person. Sorry, I didn't mean that as an insult to especially my producer Dan Shagru, who is a comic book guy. But I don't know anybody who was looking forward to Fantastic Four. Seriously, I don't know anybody who doesn't think it's going to suck. And Dan, I think, summed it up perfectly a couple of months ago, Dan, when we were talking about, you know, because they haven't made a good Fantastic Four movie yet, because the first Fantastic Four movie is like notorious and only available like on VHS bootleg.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Then you've got
the
two,
Roger Corman one.
The two with Commissioner Curly Belushi, and Jessica Alba, and then the second one was the voice of Lawrence Fishburne was the Silver Surfer, right?
Right.
Okay. Those movies suck. But Dan, yep. I believe Dan Shagru, my producer,
I think it was Eric who actually said it.
Oh no!
And I disagree with it.
Did you disagree with it? No. Eric, what did you say? Why these movies fail?
Because Fantastic Four is an incredibly stupid comic.
Now, didn't you say that too, Dan?
I agree with him.
Oh.
I can't remember now.
Well, I don't know, man. I think you said it first, Dan.
Well, I remember Eric saying it.
Oh, okay. All right. I don't know why. Why did I think that Dan was Dan said it?
Probably because I was crying as I admitted it.
Yeah. All right. Well, Mission Impossible Rogue Nation, $56 million. Over the weekend, and an interesting way to analyze that, which Eric did in his. Can people see this box office analysis anywhere, Eric, online?
Yes, at movies.com.
Movies.com.
And Fandango.com as well.
Okay, cool. Movies.com and Fandango.com. You can read Eric Childress's weekly box office analysis, which we do right here live on the show. All right, guys, hang on, okay? Eric Childress, live from Vegas. Why doesn't he just move there? Or at least get a conda, you know? Anaconda? Get a conda. All right. We'll take a quick break. We come back. More box office analysis. More little facts about the Mission Impossible movies, which there's only two. So we'll get to those. All that coming up right here on 720 WGN. Morning, everybody. It's a Monday morning, and that means later on my dad calls in and tells a joke because it's a jokey time. We will also pay tribute to one of my favorite professional wrestlers of all time, one of the best that's ever been in or out of the ring in terms of pro wrestling, An incredibly cool guy, was a very nice guy, and the star of They Live, John Carpenter's They Live. We will pay tribute to the great Roddy Piper, Rowdy, who we lost this past weekend. Eric and Colin, welcome back, guys.
Hello there. Thank you.
Yeah, Roddy Piper, man. You know?
It hit me more than I thought it was going to.
It's Piper. You know, I mean, and the thing that sucks is that, like, you know, like he was diagnosed with cancer about 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently he fought through that. And then he dies of what most professional wrestlers die of, cardiac arrest.
Yeah.
At the age of 61. You know, I don't know. It's just so weird to me that, like, kids now, young people nowadays continue to want to be professional wrestlers, seeing the list of how many of them die so young.
Yeah.
I mean, there are various reasons, obviously, but it seems like just a cursed way of making a living.
Well, if you actually listen to the They Live commentary, where, I mean, you know, Roddy Piper couldn't be more of a humble guy, and just how much he loves that movie.
One of the nicest guys I've ever met, and just wonderful to hang out with the weekend that he came to Flashback. Yeah.
But he actually talks during the commentary about how professional wrestlers have, like, one of the higher suicide rates, you know, of most professions. So
it's nuts. Absolutely nuts. Yeah. Well, anyway, we'll pay tribute to Roddy coming up a little bit later on. All right, number one in the nation is the new Mission Impossible movie, $56 million. Number two, over the weekend it made 14.8, but they released it on a Wednesday, and that total is 21.1 million vacation. What do those numbers indicate, Eric?
That people aren't really interested in seeing the new Vacation movie. The numbers kind of fluctuated throughout the entire week. It opened kind of soft, and some people were sort of thinking mid-20s. I think there was hope for maybe high 20s over the five-day weekend. So the fact that it actually got to 21 made people sleep a little bit better, but I think they were still hoping for something around like 24, 25.
What's the strategy on releasing a movie like this on a Wednesday?
I don't know. I mean, because you're not going to beat Mission Impossible. You know, if you could release it on Monday, you weren't going to beat Mission Impossible.
Right.
So the idea of, like, opening, you know, they say, well, we'll get a jump on the weekend, you know, which, you know, kind of makes sense when you're releasing something around, like, the July 4th holiday and you want to get a couple extra days in. People get to take off on July 3rd and stuff like that. But this is the third time this summer that Warner Brothers has employed this strategy. They did it with Entourage, which, you know, got up to a really big start and then had a really terrible opening weekend. And then they did the same thing with, Magic Mike, that was over the July 4th holiday.
Oh, right.
But you look at all those cases, and the numbers, you know, if they would have just released the movie on the weekend, you would have had probably more people show up just on the weekend. And the numbers would have looked maybe a little bit more impressive in a way.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, 21 million over 5 days is not the same as maybe 19 over 3 days.
Yeah.
You know, it just doesn't, I don't know. I mean, at least to box office analysts, it doesn't look as strong, because all of a sudden the story becomes that Vacation only made, you know, less than 15 million on the weekend.
Right.
As opposed to it made 21 million over 5 days.
Right. Number three on the list is...
Isn't it also interesting that, like, this summer there really hasn't been, as far as I can tell, a big comedy, like a big breakout comedy that, you know, soars past the 100 million or 150 million mark, you know? I mean,
I mean, Spy did pretty well.
Okay.
But not very well.
But I mean, like, Ted 2 didn't do very well. I guess Trainwreck did okay, or is doing okay. And just some other ones. But just, like, comedies just aren't really, grabbing people this summer.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. Yeah. Number three, a very funny movie, Ant-Man. It's a lot of laughs in that movie, man. There are.
Yes, there are.
$12.6 million, bringing its total up to $132.1 million. How are they going to spin this? Is it doing okay? Or?
Yeah, I don't think it'll be a need for spin. I mean, if people really are paying attention to the numbers, It's about at $300 million worldwide now. It doesn't need a whole lot more to actually break into profit. So it's not going to be, you know, a giant Avengers Spider-Man type profit. But at the same time, you know, it's a profit on a movie called Ant-Man.
Yeah.
So they should pat themselves on the back. And this one did just fine. And maybe, you know, if it's gonna, we'll see if it spawns its own sequels or not. Maybe it won't. But, you know, let's just say they got away with it.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's fine.
Number four, Minions. $12.2 million, bringing its total up to $287.3 million. Is this going to beat the second Despicable Me?
No, it's not going to come close. The second one did $368 million. This one's probably going to come in somewhere around $320, $315, $320 maybe.
Still a big hit, though.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Okay. Number five, wow, man. Pixels, 10.4 million. It's 2 week total, $45.6 million.
Yeah, no spin here. This is a bomb.
Wow, man.
Yeah, unless there's some magical overseas numbers on the horizon, this is the only thing that's going to lose more money this summer is Tomorrowland.
Wow. Number six, Trainwreck, $9.7 million, bringing his total up to $79.7 million total. That's solid, right?
It's solid, yeah, for a movie with an actress or a comedian that's never been in a movie before, and it's probably, you know, it looks like it's going to make $100 million. That's very solid. The production budget on it is still like 50 or 60 million total with advertising and everything, so it might come up a little bit short in making that back. But, you know, the story is going to be the fact that Amy Schumer, you know, starred in a $100 million movie.
Oh, yeah.
So that's the headline they want.
Yeah. Number seven, Southpaw, $7.5 million, bringing his total up to $31.5 million. That's got to be pretty disappointing for most people.
Yeah. That's not looking good for them.
Okay. Number eight, Paper Towns, $4.6 million, $23.8 million in 2 weeks. Boy, this thing has really tanked.
Yeah, but it's actually the overseas numbers have come in and they're pretty decent, and it's probably going to end up making its budget back. So just on the strength of the overseas numbers, so
okay.
not great. I mean, the movie's not going to make as much as Fault in Our Stars did in its opening weekend, but it's still, you know, the production budget was only $12 million.
Yeah.
So, you know, they'll be okay with this.
Now, Colin, you mentioned last week when Paper Towns came out, was it your niece?
Yeah. Not a fan of the book, not a fan of the film.
What's the author's name?
John Green.
John Green. Okay, John Green. Has he written a ton of books?
Yeah, I mean, enough to, have a loyal following. I mean, I don't know how many books he's written, but, my niece owns all of them, I'm pretty sure. So, he's got a collection. It's more than two. I know that.
Okay.
All right. So
we'll see. Let's see if some of the other ones get greenlit now.
Well, hopefully
it's actually a film.
Yeah. Well, go ahead, Eric.
I was just going to say, there's a film that I guess is, I don't know if it's officially greenlit yet, but it's called, one of his books called Looking for Alaska. And at one point, it was several months back, and I don't think she's attached to it anymore, but Sarah Polley was actually attached to directing this adaptation at one point.
Oh, boy.
I don't think she's doing it anymore, but, you know, if she was at least interested in it, you know, maybe you should pay attention.
Wow.
So.
All right.
Hopefully he doesn't become, a cliche of himself, become like the next Nicholas Sparks. You know, I think he's probably got more intelligence in his writing than that. I like to think so anyway.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Number nine is Inside Out, $4.5 million, bringing its total up to $329.5 million. Where does that stand in the Pixar world?
It's a little more than $10 million behind Finding Nemo right now, which is the second highest grossing film in their history.
Wow.
And it's going to outgross Minions. So success all around.
Wow.
Inside Out.
That's great.
Great.
That's great. And then number 10, it just won't leave. Jurassic World, $3.8 million, bringing its total up to $631.5 million.
Yeah, only that much.
Is there possibly one of the reasons why maybe there were a bunch of really little kids who grew up on these movies, and there hasn't been one on the big screen in 15 years that did this?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what it was. I think that, you know, I mean, they released the original in 3D a few years ago, and that actually did pretty well, right, when that sort of fad was dying, you know, re-releasing movies in 3D. And I saw, I think that, you know, there are a lot of kids that have probably, you know, like you said, grown up with the series or come to, you know, see them later, much later than we did. And now all of a sudden they got one of their own.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because if you think about it, and the third one came out like in it was either 2000 or 2001.
Right.
So, I mean, either way, it was either 15 or 14 years ago. That the movie was released, and that's a right there, that's a kid.
Right.
You know what I mean? That's a 14-year-old kid who's going to go see the Jurassic World.
Right.
So, I don't know, but the numbers are kind of staggering. God. by the way, I don't know if you guys know this or not, but Apple paid $15 million to have their personal computers in the first Mission Impossible movie.
And the technology looks so great today, too.
Yeah. Did they use Apple in that Welcome to Planet Earth, that piece of crap with Will Smith, the Independence Day?
Oh, I don't remember that.
I just remember watching that movie. God, do I hate that movie. I hate that movie with every fiber of my being. I hate Independence Day so much. But I remember watching the idiotic movie, and him and Goldblum end up on the ship, the alien ship. And I'm sitting there, and I'm like, well, I remember watching it. The ship gets destroyed. I'm like, well, I'm glad that the aliens are Apple compatible.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? I'm like, what the hell, man? There's so many stupid things in that movie. Oh my.
Well,
God.
I've noticed in a lot of movies, like in general, or a lot of thrillers anyway. It's like nobody's using a Mac or a PC. Everybody's using this sort of like nondescript platform that's just like, you know, plugged in there, you know, as an after effect.
Right.
But nobody's using like a real computer in movies anymore. Which I always look for when I watch a movie now. I always go to see what kind of computer they're using.
Okay. So. All right. Let's take a quick break here. Eric and Colin are here. We'll review the two new movies. And we got more to talk about coming up right here on the Monday Morning Movie Reviews. Nick DiGilio, more with Eric and Colin coming up right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here on Chicago's very own 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio, and I'm going to sneeze. Hey. Thank you. I like to announce it because, like, sometimes, like, you know, if you cough or you sneeze or something and you hit the button to cover it up, there's dead air. So I like to let everybody know that I'm going to sneeze, which is why you're going to hear maybe a couple of seconds of dead air. Eric Childress, Colin Suter, it's the Monday Morning Movie Reviews, we're going to get to the reviews coming up right here on 720 WGN. Then we're going to talk about some of the best movie franchises and series. Here's Eric Childress and Colin Suter. Hey, are you guys coming out to Stripes a week from tomorrow?
Planning on it, yes.
So what's the plan? What? I'm sorry, go ahead. Eric first.
I'm planning on it, yes.
Okay, and Colin?
Yeah, I'm hoping to, yeah.
All right, cool. We're going to be doing it. Now, the reason why we're not doing it this Tuesday is because Mike Kurz, who helps me put together the film club every month, he and his wife, Mia, have kind of an event, kind of a big event, their annual Flashback Horror Convention, which Mike runs. So he's obviously in prep right now and organizing flights and getting everything ready and putting people into rooms and getting everything set up for the big Flashback Horror Convention weekend, which is going to be a blast. There's an outdoor screening of John Carpenter's Halloween. There's a screening of Reanimator. Svengoolie's going to be there. As he is every year, but he's actually going to be hosting a screening of the Mad Monster Party, the great Rankin and Bass animated Halloween special featuring Boris Karloff and Phyllis Diller. And Svengoolie will be there to host that. There's going to be a lot of a concert by Alan Howarth, who worked on scores with John Carpenter and is going to be doing a concert with all kinds of like crazy stuff going on. Everybody who's ever played Michael Myers essentially is going to be there. There's going to be a pretty cool reunion of most cast and crew of the original Halloween, including Dean Cundey, one of the greatest cinematographers of all time. He will be there. A great lineup. Check out flashbackweekend.com. But because of that, we're going to be doing our screening of Stripes a week from tomorrow, August 11th. August 11th, we are showing Stripes with Bill Murray, Harold Ramis, John Candy, one of the funniest movies ever made, in my opinion, one of the Holy Trinity of comedy. The Holy Trinity of comedy, as I've mentioned before, is Animal in chronological order, Animal House, Caddyshack, Stripes. And I'm sure that we'll take care of Caddyshack as one of the film club screenings coming up. So that's
you're getting. Do you know if you're playing the theatrical version of Stripes or the longer version?
No, the theatrical version, because there's a reason why they cut some of that stuff out. Except they they cut out PJ Soul's nude scene, which I think is weird. But yeah, I mean, there's obviously you guys know the background. The original script for this movie was a Cheech and Chong vehicle.
Yeah,
right.
It was supposed to be a Cheech and Chong movie, which explains that whole section in the extended cut where they're on the plane and they end up blowing weed. It's like, what? Where did this come from?
Yeah, right.
So anyway, no, it's the theatrical cut. We'll be showing the regular theatrical cut of Stripes, one of the funniest movies ever made. So please come out and check that out. It is you can make your reservations right now. Go to MovieCo.com. That's MUVICO. MovieCo.com, MUVICO. Reserve your seats right now for August 11th. Starts at 8 o'clock, MovieCo Theater in Rosemont. Reserve your seats now for Stripes on the big screen. All right, by the way, this is very disappointing, and I know, Eric, you'll be very disappointed as well. What's going on now? Are you in the... Are you in the waterfalls in front of Caesars? What the hell is?
I am not. No, that was just a couple of janitors going by the hallway.
Okay, all right. Well, let me just let me say this. This is and Colin, you'll be very disappointed. I was devastated. Disney won't let us have Roger Rabbit for December.
Yeah.
I was afraid of that.
I'm aware of their policies.
Yeah. So Disney was like, "Nah, you can't have it," and I'm like, "Oh, that's fantastic." So now I have to pick. I haven't picked it yet. But now I have to pick a movie for the 50th. It will be the 50th film that we've shown. But but we do have September, October, and November, and we've decided for those fall months that we are going to pick movies from classic directors. So these are confirmed. September, we will be showing the restored cut of Touch of Evil.
Cool.
In October, we will be showing Hitchcock's Psycho.
Nice.
And in November, I know I'm breaking the length of movie rule, but we're showing Goodfellas in November.
Nice.
Yeah. So, and then in December, I'm going to pick the movie. It might not be a Christmas movie, and I'm leaning towards Risky Business for December.
Yeah. Okay.
So, yeah, I figured if I'm going to pick one of my favorite movies, you know, I'm already breaking the cardinal rule in November by showing Goodfellas, so there's no way I can show a movie that's 3 hours and 12 minutes long like Magnolia. So,
right.
All right, guys, hang on.
Okay.
All right, Eric Childress, Colin Suter, we will take a break and come back and review the new movies right here on 720 WGN. Nick DiGilio here. We are live in the Allstate studio on the seventh floor of the Trib Tower. Monday morning movie reviews, and we're actually going to get to the movie reviews in a second here. Have you guys watched Wet Hot American Summer yet?
Only the first episode.
I'm sorry, Colin?
Only the first episode.
Okay, Eric?
Not yet, no.
Yeah, neither have I. What did you think of the first episode, Colin?
It's pretty funny. I mean, it's got, you know, some holes here and there, just, you know, sort of comedy gaps here and there. But, I mean, it's, you know, what David Wayne is trying to do, I think, is kind of funny.
With
that series.
I'm very excited about it. I got to say,
yeah.
I'm very, very excited about it. I love the movie. I think the movie is
excellent.
And it's one of those movies that I think gets better with age.
Yeah.
People totally missed the boat on that movie when it came out. They really did.
Well, it's really going, I mean, it's parodying a really, like, narrow, like,
yes.
a really niche genre of comedy that you really have to kind of know what you're getting into when you watch that movie to understand what David Wayne and that group is going for.
Right.
And they're taking it a step further with the series in a way that is just kind of bizarre in a good way.
Okay, cool. So. All right, Colin, tell us about the Stanford Prison Experiment.
Yeah, so this is a movie. This is based on a true story. In 1971, this doctor, who in the movie is played by Billy Crudup, this sort of psychologist wanted to do an experiment about institutionalization and basically what happens to prisoners when they're sort of stripped of their individuality. So he put an ad in the paper asking, you know, for anybody, any male college students who wanted to volunteer in this experiment and play this sort of mock prison, to come on in and be interviewed. And basically 75 people showed up, and he took 24 of these guys and randomly assigned them roles of either prisoner or prison guard. Most of the guys wanted to be prisoners because it'd be a lot easier than being a prison guard. So in the movie, Ezra Miller and Ty Sheridan are two of the many other guys who are, you know, going to be prisoners.
You know, I wish Ty Sheridan would stop doing these big budget blockbusters.
Right. Yeah. He's just the indies love him.
Yeah.
And why not? So the experiment is basically takes place in this hallway that is like this makeshift prison, and Billy Crudup and his colleagues are sort of observing through video cameras the effects of being in an institution, having your rights taken away. But then things went a little too far when some of the guys who are playing prison guards took their role a little too seriously and got extremely abusive and verbally, taunting and humiliating these guys to no end, to the point where everybody was just kind of starting to break. And so the movie depicts this, for the most part, rather well. It's a movie that works better as a prison film than as a study in psychology. I think the screenplay sort of short shifts what the doctor was kind of going for. It doesn't really explain it very well. The sort of, psychological, sociological, anthropological, whatever you want to call it, study of being in a prison, it sort of gets lost in the narrative in this film, which I found kind of unfortunate. After a while, the movie runs 2 hours. And after a while, you're kind of just waiting for, I mean, you know, the experiment isn't going to follow through. The experiment was supposed to last for 2 weeks, and it only lasted for 6 days. I'm not spoiling anything. That's on the poster.
Right.
So you're kind of just waiting after a while. You just kind of want to see the aftermath of the experiment and how these guys relate to each other in the aftermath. And what happens, how the ending is handled, I thought was kind of unsatisfactory, and it sort of lacked conviction. I saw a little bit too much acting going on in the very last part of this film that sort of left kind of a sour note. And sort of made me think that this might have made a more interesting documentary, even though in the moment when watching it, it is very compelling and it does tell a very interesting story, one that I'd never heard before, that had a lot of potential for a little bit more in food for thought when walking out of the film. It's not a bad film. The acting is terrific. The directing is, I think, pretty terrific. But I just think the screenplay itself comes up a bit short. So I'm only kind of giving this a mild recommendation.
Okay.
Interesting movie, interesting story. Only playing at the Landmark Century.
It's also on On Demand.
It is on demand.
Yes,
okay.
It is. I was going to watch it, but it was kind of late and I was a little bit dozy, and I don't want to like get charged for something that I fall asleep during.
You know, I saw it this morning, and I was really tired. I wasn't in the mood to watch anything about prison, but I got kind of sucked into it.
It's an easy
movie to get sucked into.
Yeah, I'm really interested in seeing it. So that's the Stanford Prison Experiment at the Landmark Century Cinemas in Chicago and also on demand. All right, Eric, tell us about Vacation.
Okay. This is a continuation of the National Lampoon's Vacation franchise that began in 1983 with Chevy Chase and Beverly D'Angelo and directed by Mr. Harold Ramis.
Yep.
This is the first vacation movie in 18 years since the Griswold family went to Las Vegas.
God, was that 18 years ago?
1997.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Yeah. I had only been to Vegas once at that point. Actually, that's not true. Because fun story, I actually saw them filming Vegas Vacation when we came out here.
Okay.
One scene. So right. There's that. Not very interesting. But anyway, so now it's 2015, and this movie deals with Rusty Griswold, now played by Ed Helms, who's grown up and has a family of his own. He's found that he's sort of losing touch with his family. They sort of take the same vacation up to their little cabin every summer. His wife, played by Christine Applegate, is clearly seen in the photos of the cabin trip. Not really enjoying it year by year. He has two young boys. The younger son bullies the older son. So things are not going well at the Griswold compound. So he decides that he's going to bring them to the very spot where his father took him so many years ago, to Wally World. And thus begins a series of mishaps and misadventures and misjudgments, very much like what we saw back in 1983 with his father. So you have a film here that wants to, in some ways, capture the spirit of the original while being its own film, but still capitalize on some of the characters that we've grown to like over the years in varying degrees. Both Chevy Chase and Beverly D'Angelo do make cameo appearances in the film. This is a real missed opportunity of a film, I think. And I think that's even saying it a little bit lightly, because when I first saw the preview for this movie, and one of the kids has a line in the movie, says, "So you're basically going to recreate your vacation from 30 years ago." I thought, okay, if they would have stopped right there, and maybe started with the idea of actually going back to revisit all of the locations from the original movie, that might have been a very interesting trip in nostalgia, even if some of these places don't exist anymore. But they don't, so they tried to, recapture some of the misadventures and stuff that we came to know from the first film. And they do so in very sporadically sporadic failures throughout the film. It's a really crazily misdirected film in many, many ways. There are sequences in this movie that are sort of built up and then have absolutely no payoff whatsoever. There are other moments in the film where there's one particular moment in the film involving a trucker that has maybe the biggest laugh of the movie, and then in the very next scene they completely undercut the very joke and make it a lot ickier and gross and not funny. And that's sort of the case. They go for a lot of gross-out gags in the film. They do have some fun with Rusty renting this Albanian car, sort of the replacement for the family truckster from the original, that I think gets a couple laughs, but I don't think they handle a lot of those laughs very appropriately. And the biggest question I have about this entire movie, and I think one of the reasons it fails so spectacularly, is why is Rusty Griswold such a moron in this movie? Rusty Griswold, who they make very clear in the film, is the same character he was through all the different incarnations of all the different actors who played him over the years. Why is Rusty Griswold such a naive idiot? He was never like that, ever. He was always a little bit ahead of, where Clark's naivete was. By the Christmas vacation, he was full-on sarcastic. So the consistency in that character never really works. Christina Applegate does as much with her role as she possibly can. It's just a reminder that I'd like to see her in more comedies. They don't do anything with Leslie Mann as Audrey in the film. They put the spotlight on Chris Hemsworth's character, who basically becomes sort of a one-joke thing, even though they completely set him up to be some really heavy right-wing nut. And they do nothing with that. So the movie is kind of toothless, and it's sporadically, it does have some laughs. I can't admit that I didn't laugh at the film. But it's a really kind of a poor effort from the two directors who wrote Horrible Bosses and a few other comedies. It's kind of a really poor bag.
Okay. All right, Eric, hang on. Colin, hang on. We'll get Colin's thoughts on the new vacation movie and mine as well. Morning, everybody. It's a Monday morning. That means it's time for the Monday morning movie reviews. Eric just told us all about Vacation and gave us his thoughts on it. Colin, what about you?
Yeah, I'm not quite as down on it. I think I laughed probably a little bit more than Eric did. I love everything with the car. I think the car upstages. It's funny to watch the cast being upstaged by an inanimate object, but it's true. I think just some of this weird, like useless stuff on that car just made me laugh out loud. Like that should be its own movie. And I like, you know, what happens, you know, when they finally get to Wally World and what what they have to endure for that is more closer to reality than, you know, what Chevy Chase did in the original film. I think people watch that and actually kind of relate to it, you know, but, you know, some of the things you have to endure when going to an amusement park. So I thought that was funny. I think some of it works and then a lot of it doesn't for the very reasons that Eric mentioned. There's a lot of buildup to a big, you know, payoff that doesn't really follow through. There's a scene in which Christina Applegate's character revisits her college days, and it kind of happens, you know, rather predictably. The stuff with, Chris Hemsworth and Leslie Mann, I think I laughed maybe once or twice during that segment, just about how Leslie Mann just keeps trying to get her husband to realize that she wants to go back to work. There's a funny moment in there. But yeah, it's very hit or miss, and you know, I'd say it's like 40% hit, 60% miss. I think some of the stuff with the two brothers is funny, but you know, on the whole, it's just kind of, you know, it's trying to get by on you know, crassness, or I mean, just you know, sort of you know, crude humor. And I think what it lacks ultimately is the heart of the original film. You know, there's that scene in the original film when, Rusty and Clark are, you know, sort of bonding over that beer. And that's the stuff that, you know, John Hughes always meant to put in all of his films, is a, you know, moment of heart, a moment of bonding of some kind between two of the characters, so that it's not all just about getting to the next gag. And I think that's the one thing that the movie ultimately lacks, is this, you know, believability of this family, you know, coming together for this vacation that, you know, it's supposed to sort of bring them together. And it does for the married couple a little bit, but the brothers, I never really felt like there was anything there between them except, you know, just being malicious. Some of which is funny, but it's not quite enough to, you know, make up for the hole that's in the film. So I laughed probably more than Eric did, but on the whole, I think the movie is it's a bit of a misfire.
Yeah, well, I didn't like it at all. I just didn't laugh during this movie, and I found it to be really, really desperate. It just, the word that popped into my head while I was watching it was just desperate. Like, to me, at least seemed like every gag, the grosser it got, or the more crass it got, the more tired I got watching it. And you know, you mentioned heart, Colin. There's not just the scene where they share the beer, but there's also that scene after. Chevy Chase jumps in the pool and screams and wakes everybody up in the hotel with Christy Brinkley in the pool. And then I love, it's one of my favorite moments in the movie is when it's Rusty and Audrey are standing over the balcony looking, and their dad has just made a complete ass of himself, you know, in front of everything and gotten his wife angry at him. Where Rusty just goes, yeah, I better go talk to him.
Yeah,
he goes down, and they have a pretty nice scene together. Yeah, the heart thing, that is a Hughes thing, but for me, the reason why so much of the original Vacation works is because of Harold Ramis's touch. You know, with the material. Now, there's a lot of crass material in the original Vacation, not nearly as much as you know the stuff that's in this one. But, you know, a lot of people talk about, like, the scene where Jane Krakowski says that, you know, like, my dad says I'm the best French kisser, You know, like your first reaction to that line is, ew. But for some reason, in Harold Ramis's hands, you go, ew, and then you laugh. Mm-hmm. Dragging a dog behind a car on a leash should not be funny. But in the hands of Harold Ramis, it is. Putting a dead ant on top of a car, you know, tying her to the roof of the car in a rainstorm. That's a tasteless thing, but it works. All of the stuff in this movie is so heavy-handed and gross that I just didn't find any of it. And, you know, by the way, there are like 8,000 cameos in this movie. Like, everybody's in this movie. And for no good reason. You know, there's a lot of really talented people who have small roles in this movie who had no business being in it. I think I laughed maybe a couple of times. And again, I think the funniest thing in the movie, the thing that gave me the most amusement, what little amusement I got from this movie, was indeed the car. So, no. That's all I'm saying. All right, Colin, before we break, very quickly, if you can, give us the synopsis of the new Mission Impossible movie, which, by the way, I believe is a Mission Impossible. But go ahead, Colin.
Thank you. Yeah, so this is the fifth movie in the series and follows Tom Cruise and his crew made up of Simon Pegg and Bing Rhames and Jeremy Renner. That's sort of your core group right there. Their organization is about to be dissolved for being, rogue and unethical and, you know, all these other things. So Cruise and his team are on the tail of this organization called the Syndicate, which is this other rogue group hell-bent on destroying the IMF. But Cruise and his team, they sort of have to search for these guys without the, you know, FBI, CIA, or anybody else in the American government knowing about it. So they're, you know, in Europe and, you know, trying to track these guys down. Rebecca Ferguson is sort of the femme fatale here. We never quite know whose side she's on. Alec Baldwin is in it as well. I don't know, do you want me to go on more? Is that good enough?
No, I think that's good enough. When we come back, it's a Mission Impossible movie, so there's a lot of crazy stuff going on.
Exactly.
That's all you need. Okay, hang on, you guys. We'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll give Colin's review of the new Mission Impossible movie, Eric's review and mine as well of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Monday morning movie reviews continue on 720 WGN. All righty then. Good morning, everybody. Monday morning movie reviews. Continuing with Eric Childress and Colin Suter with me right here. And Colin just gave us the brief synopsis of the new Mission Impossible movie. Oh, Rogue Nation. And we welcome back Colin and Eric. Hi, guys.
Hello there.
All right.
What was that?
That was me pressing the wrong button and then, you know, being an idiot about it. All right. Colin, what did you think of Mission Impossible Rogue Nation?
Man, this is everything I want in a blockbuster. It just hits the ground running. Right off the bat, the movie is an action movie.
Yeah, I just want to mention really quickly. Like, in the commercials, they've been showing Cruise hanging off the side of this plane.
Right.
And you're thinking, okay, man, that's going to happen during the last 15 minutes of the movie.
Right.
They open with it. They open with it.
Yep, pretty much. it's a lot like the dust storm in Mad Max. We all thought that was going to be the climax.
Yeah. Nope.
We're just getting started. All right, cool. So like right off the bat, the movie just like, you know, sets itself up for just like, well, how can you top that? Well, it does. There's like we were talking about earlier, a scene that happens backstage that is very, you know, I guess De Palma-esque, although I don't, was there a split screen in it? I don't remember.
No.
No. Okay. All right.
And it was not, and there was no slow motion either.
Right.
So, yeah.
Yeah.
Or diopter shots.
With the amount of stuff that was going on in that scene, there very well could have, you know, there could have been a split screen, but it's so well executed and you get a clear sense of everything that's happening, the geography of everything. And I think the incorporating of the opera in that scene is brilliant.
Yep.
And actually, if you pay attention to the score throughout the rest of the film, the opera is worked into the score at various points in the film, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah,
what's going on there?
Yeah, I have no idea. Especially when you hear those little pieces of the opera pop up. It's mostly between Tom Cruise and Rebecca Ferguson scenes.
Right. Exactly. And then I think probably the scene I will remember the most is this unbearable scene where Cruise has to go underwater to fix something. And, oh, my God, I almost had a heart attack during this scene. I think it's the centerpiece of the film. Everything else in the film I think is really great. Great bad guy, great, fun supporting characters, really funny dialogue. The stuff with Jeremy Renner and Alec Baldwin at the beginning and at the end of the film is beautiful. It's just smartly written. Cruise, deserves a lot of credit for producing this and then Edge of Tomorrow last summer. Like, he's really going out of his way to create quality blockbuster entertainment. I don't think he gets enough credit for putting this stuff together and making sure it's the best that it can be, because this is just top of the line summer popcorn blockbuster entertainment that really I can't wait to see again.
Yeah. Okay. Eric.
The only argument anyone should ever have about this movie is which action sequence they like the best.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. The only reason we're not calling this like one of the best, the best action film of the summer is because we had Mad Max.
Yeah.
That's the bar that this movie is playing with. We can make an argument over, which is the best in the series. And I think a very quality one can be made for this one. I think someone on the show will be saying that very shortly. But it's such an amazing piece of work. From top to bottom, it's just like every action sequence crackles. I have not been this giddy in a movie just watching everything unfold, and I would sit, up in my chair and sit forward just anticipating every new beat. The opera scene is just fantastic and full of humor, and the choreography of everything that's going on, you know exactly where all the players fit. And it's just, it gets up to the point where you're ready for anything. Anything could possibly happen in this movie. It plays fair with the audience in, a lot of some of the crazy twists that happen through the movie. I don't think we've said enough about Rebecca Ferguson yet. You want to talk about a star-making, role? This is it right here, because I want to see her in the next movie. I think she's fantastic. She's very easy on the eyes, obviously. But she, of all the sort of the femme fatales that we've had throughout this series, I think she's absolutely the best one. Tom Cruise makes movies for us people. And, there's a lot of people out there who still want to play their little, Tom Cruise, I don't care what his politics, what his religion is, any of that stuff. I'm just interested in what he's putting out on the screen. And like Colin said, I don't think he gets enough credit, for putting out a piece of entertainment like this when just about any other franchise, and we'll be talking about this in a minute, would be on fumes at this point.
Yeah.
Look at the fifth Die Hard movie, for God's sake. Look at the fifth Terminator movie, for God's sake. These movies just keep getting better. And Tom Cruise is a large part of that reason. And give it up for Christopher McQuarrie, too, who I think has done some good work behind the camera. I was a big fan of his debut, Way of the Gun. I think Jack Reacher is a pretty decent film, and obviously he showed a flair for action in that movie. But, man, does he hit a grand slam with this one. This is one of the best movies of the summer, one of the best movies of the year.
I'm with you guys. I think it's the best of the series. It's weird how I think these movies just get better and better. Well, not for the second one. Which I back, actually. I like the second one, but I don't think it's better. It doesn't just get better. I don't think it's better than the first one. But I enjoyed the second one, as flawed as it is. But these movies get better and better. I thought the third one was great, and then the fourth one was great, and I think this is just great stuff, too. And I'm a Tom Cruise fan. Always have been, always will be, and he's a smart guy, And like you guys said, I mean, he puts together great big budget, spectacular, entertaining movies. And this is a very entertaining movie. And you mentioned Rebecca Ferguson, who's terrific in it. I do want to mention Sean Harris as the bad guy, who I thought was great.
Yeah.
And by the way, my dad went nuts over him. He's like, who is that guy? It's the best bad guy ever. I saw it in IMAX, and I thought my head was going to explode. My parents, it was my parents' first encounter with IMAX. And after the first trailer that they showed in IMAX, my dad leans over to me and he goes, well, I'm not going to have any trouble hearing this. what can you say about Jeremy Renner and Ving Rhames? A lot of fun. I love the fact that Simon Pegg is pretty much in on every big action sequence in this movie.
Yeah, he's not just on the sidelines.
He's the second, and he's the dude. He's like Tom Cruise's dude in this. And I adore that. I love the fact that Simon Pegg is like in on all the big action sequences. Now, granted, for the most part, he's comic relief. That fantastic car motorcycle chase is just, I mean, fantastic when the car flips over and all that great stuff. And then what kills me about that is that that scene goes on. It's unbelievable. The car flips over, okay? They're both in the car. It's upside down. And then what does Cruise do? He picks up a pair of sunglasses, jumps on a motorcycle, and goes on again.
Yeah.
Like, let's continue this, shall we? Let's continue this kick-ass action sequence.
And all of that is after the underwater sequence.
Yeah, I know. It's ridiculous. Yeah. After, like, he dies and then comes back to life. It's fantastic.
Right.
It is a tremendous movie. Extraordinarily well done. I didn't think McQuarrie could do action. I mean, I liked Jack Reacher. I thought it was fine. I'm not a fan of Way of the Gun. I got to go back and rewatch it. I haven't seen it since it came out. But this is just great. This is great blockbuster entertainment. And had Mad Max not been released this year, I would say that this is the best action movie of the year, but it's not. Mad Max Fury Road is still reigns supreme. But then, I mean, I don't know how anybody – I mean, that's one of those deals where, you put the – bar so high.
Yeah.
Right.
Like what are we going to do here?
Right.
So, anyway. Let me give you this then. Ian McKellen turned down the role of Swanbeck in Mission Impossible 2 that ultimately went to Anthony Hopkins. Did you guys know that?
I did not know that.
No. He was only given parts of the script to read and he went, "No." Nope. And the next day he turned it down. The next day he was offered Magneto. Robert Towne was still writing the script for the sequel after the filming had been completed. There's a surprise. The movie was being edited, and he continued to write. Scarlett Johansson, Kenneth Branagh, Carrie Ann Moss, and Ricky Gervais were all slated to star in MI3.
Yes.
Is that true?
I knew about ScarJo. Yeah.
Okay. All right. The original director, David Finch. If David Fincher was the original director of the third Mission Impossible?
Yep.
Due to creative differences, Joe Carnahan walked away from it. And so a lot of those people, Gervais left too, so the part went to Simon Pegg. Tom Cruise met Katie Holmes when she auditioned to play his fiance in the third one. Yeah. J.J. Abrams got the part of got the director's gig because of Alias. Tom Cruise binged on DVDs of Abrams' spy show, liked it so much that he offered him the directing job.
I think J.J. Abrams like moved into his house at one point to work on the film.
Yeah. let's see. Maggie Q learned how to drive from Mission Impossible 3.
But I won't make it.
Paramount's promotion for the third movie led to panic and destruction. Paramount placed digital audio players that played the Mission Impossible theme song when the doors at 4,500 random vending boxes containing copies of the Los Angeles Times were opened. When some of the players came loose and landed on top of stacks of the newspapers, people thought that the boxes were bombs. One newsstand was actually blown up by the Los Angeles County Arson Squad for precautionary reasons. Hey, didn't something similar happen when those goofballs who made the Aqua Teen movie?
Hunger Force.
Yeah.
Yes.
Then when
they got him, like, they hung one of the Moonanites from the bridge.
Yeah.
Oh man! All right. Let's see. Tom Cruise actually did climb the tallest building in the world for Ghost Protocol. Yeah, we know, man. We know that. That's not an unknown fact. And Ethan Hunt's house was made to look just like J.J. Abrams' house. When needing Cruise's character to have an average middle-class abode at the start of MI3, the director asked the production designer to make it just like his Los Angeles home. And then after he saw the footage, Abrams apparently found the similarity, quote-unquote, a little disturbing. Okay. There's some more facts about the Mission Impossible movies.
Okay.
All right. Listen, next week, I don't know if I'm going to be able to get for our movie reviews. I don't know if I'm going to be able to get to the movies because I will be at the Flashback weekend all weekend. And if you want to, you should get your tickets now. It's going to be a blast. And it's flashbackweekend.com. Always a good time. If you're a horror film fan, you can't afford to miss it. From Friday the 7th through Sunday the 9th at the Crown Plaza Hotel in Rosemont, go to Flashback Weekend right now. Get your tickets. Check out the schedule. Check out the celebrities. It's going to be a blast. But we have the Fantastic Four is probably just the big one, right? That's the biggest one?
Yeah, that's the big one next week.
Okay. And that's the only one we got. And am I going to see you guys over the weekend at the Flashback?
No,
I might be there on Saturday. I'm getting back late Friday night. So
okay, from Vegas.
Yeah, that's right.
Are you up?
I've been down, but then I get back up.
Okay, Chumba. Oh, man, you beat me to it. All right.
Yeah.
All right, so we got Fantastic Four next week, and I will give you guys a review if you don't come. I will give you guys a full review of what happened at Flashback Weekend, which is going to be a blast. Eric, best of luck to you, man.
Thank you.
All right. Colin, always good to talk to you, buddy.
All right.
And we'll talk to you next week.